Urban violence, the violence that plagues the most disadvantaged communities in our cities, accounts for more murders and homicides than any other kind of crime. Some see this challenge as insurmountable, but as Harvard scholar Thomas Apt argues in his new book, Bleeding Out, The Devastating Consequences of Urban Violence and a Bold New Plan for Peace in the Streets, there is a roadmap for creating that peace. In the book, App shows that most violent crime is perpetrated by small numbers of people who have been violently victimized themselves. To curb such crime, he believes we must focus our attention on the highest risk individuals with a combination of empathy and resolve. Thomas Apt is a senior research fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. The name of the new book is Bleeding Out, and it's a pleasure to welcome Thomas Apt to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
What brought you to this particular subject and to develop this plan, which we'll talk about in a moment?
I've been working on this subject, dealing with issues of criminal justice and in particular urban violence for about two decades, and I've looked at it from several different angles. First, from as a high school teacher in an inner city school, then as a prosecutor, then as a federal policymaker, and then finally, then as a state level policymaker, and then finally, and currently as a researcher.
When it comes to the baseline knowledge that you believe we should have when it comes to violent crime and especially urban violence, what is that? What should we know?
I think the most important thing for your audience to understand about urban violence is just how concentrated it is. I like to describe urban violence as sticky, meaning that it concentrates in a surprisingly small number of people and places. And it's important to understand that even in the most allegedly dangerous neighborhoods or communities, most people in those communities are not dangerous. And in fact, many of the streets and blocks in those neighborhoods are also not dangerous. Violence concentrates much more than that.
How so? In the fact that it is ultimately perpetrated by very small numbers of people?
Sure. So, for instance, I'm talking to you from Boston, Massachusetts. Here in Boston, we have the Boston Regional Intelligence Center, and that center tracks many of the most high-impact, high-risk individuals in the city. The number of people that they are focused on at any one time, is about 300 to 400 people, and that's about the same number of people that you would see in many cities of the same size. Now, if you have more violence than Boston, you'll have more people. And if you have less, you'll have less. But it's important for people to understand that while this is a very serious issue, it's also a quite narrow issue, and that you can make a big difference by focusing on a small number of people and places.
One of the things that you talk about in the book, which is, to your point from just a moment ago, is that these are people, the small numbers of people who are committing these crimes have been violently victimized themselves. How do we know that?
We know that anecdotally. We know that when we ask them. We know it when we look at their family court records, their juvenile court records, and their adult records. Many of the so-called shooters who I've met and interviewed have been shot multiple times. They come from backgrounds where they've been abused, they've been neglected. The phenomenon of PTSD is something that we often think of when we think of veterans coming back from conflict, but in many of these neighborhoods, many individuals are suffering from precisely the same symptoms as veterans.
So in the book, you believe that to curb all of this, we should be looking at the violence itself. You can look at the drugs, you can look at the gangs, you can look at the guns, but before you do all of that, you have to focus on the people and then ultimately the places where this is happening.
That's right. Ultimately, 30 years of social science can be boiled down into one point with regard to urban violence, which is if you want to reduce urban violence, focus on urban violence and focus on it directly. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't advance smart-on-crime drug policies, that we shouldn't pursue reasonable restrictions on gun control, or that we shouldn't, you know, continue to fight inequality and poverty all around the country. But it's very important for people to understand that you don't have to wait for progress on those root causes in order to make a difference right now.
In making a difference right now, what does that look like?
What it looks like is first doing a very careful problem analysis, reviewing, you know, a year, 2 years, 3 years worth of homicide data and shooting data, and mapping out where these crimes are taking place and who is involved, and then doing social network analysis to map the connections between all of these people. And what will emerge in any given city, because this is surprisingly consistent city to city, is a very small network of individuals operating in a very limited number of places. And then what you need to do is craft a series of interventions that do two things. Number one, they send a clear message that further violence, shootings, and killings will not be tolerated, and that if the violence continues, there will be consequences. But also that if people put down the guns and want to change their lives, that there will be services and support and treatment available to them. It can't be just stick. It also has to be carrot as well. And this is something that you see that's sort of a problem in this area. So many people have so many priors about this subject, about urban violence, that they generally favor sort of enforcement-only approaches or prevention-only approaches. And the science says that you need both. And then I think the final point is that when you focus on the violence itself and when you develop these balanced strategies, the last thing you need to do is implement them in a way that's perceived as fair. One of the things we know now is that legitimacy is absolutely crucial to long-term violence reduction. And anybody who's, reading the paper these days knows that legitimacy is a real question when it comes to American criminal justice. So whatever you do, it has to be viewed as legitimate by the impacted communities who you will be working with.
Thomas Apt is our guest. The name of the new book is Bleeding Out: The Devastating Consequences of Urban Violence and a Bold New Plan for Peace in the Streets. How do we define, and is it possible, in your opinion, to find a definition of what fair and respectful policing is?
Yes, I think there's a body of work, a body of academic work called procedural fairness or procedural justice that was pioneered by Yale law professor and psychologist Tom Tyler, and then continued by another law professor at Yale, Tracy Mears. And this concept has been studied for decades, and it shows that when people believe that they are fairly treated, when the decision-making impacting them is perceived to be neutral, very importantly, when they are given a voice in the processes that are impacting them, and finally, that they are given notice and transparency and understanding of why these processes that are impacting them are impacting them. If you have all of those things, people will comply with these processes, be they in the workplace, be they in court, or be they in the community, even if the particular outcome doesn't favor them.
I do want to go back to something that you mentioned just a moment ago, and that is in regards to law enforcement. You believe that law enforcement must cooperate with social service and healthcare providers to make sure that this is a balanced system. How difficult is that ultimately, and what are the challenges in doing that, in creating that balance?
It's quite difficult because in many places, these various communities have a lot of tension with one another, and it makes collaboration and coordination quite difficult. But in the cities that successfully reduce violence and use these partnerships, they're doing it every day. And there are police officers and former gang members who, used to fight it out on the streets, who are now meeting and collaborating on how to reduce shootings and killings. So people who used to hate each other are working together these days. And it's not always easy, but it can be done. And so I think that's important when we think about balance, providing balanced approaches.
You believe that it can be done, and you believe that if it is done, we can cut the numbers that we're seeing by half.
I do believe that. And, just to go back to this idea of balance, it's really about partnership. I'm fond of saying that we're either going to do this together or not at all. And I think that's very important. When you're working with police, you need to send a strong message that they have to include the community. And when you're working with the community, you have to send the strong message that police need to be involved as well.
You make the point, which I find really interesting, is that you don't need legislation to do this. These are violence reduction strategies that you can just start.
Yeah, I looked at this carefully, and I'm a former policymaker. And so I, at the federal level and at the state level, understand that many different strategies have a legislative component, they have a budget component, they have a legal component, and so on. But when I asked myself, having looked at these strategies, what was really needed in order to implement them, the answer was quite simple, and it was funding. Really what we need is a little bit of funding properly spent. And it's important to understand that you can do a significant amount with relatively small amounts of funding, a fraction of a percent of the city's budget or a fraction of a percent of a state or federal budget, and make a big difference because of this theme of focus. You don't have to spread these dollars everywhere. You just have to work with the people in places that matter most.
And if you extrapolate that, you say that if we cut these homicides by 50%, we save 12,000 lives, and you ultimately save the country $121 billion. So that's an investment
right.
that you would be making.
Yes, and the return on investment is over 100 to 1. And let me explain how I arrive at those figures. The first assumption I make is that if you use a series of evidence-informed strategies that are detailed in the book, things like the group violence reduction strategy, things like cognitive behavioral therapy, hotspots policing, urban greening, and other strategies, if you combine a few of these strategies together, that you can achieve a 10% reduction in crime in your city year over year for 8 years. That 10% reduction, if you can achieve it over 8 years, adds up to more than a 50% reduction in crime and homicide. I believe this is a very conservative estimate because the programs and policies that are discussed in the book are capable of achieving those amounts of violence reductions simply on their own with just one intervention. So I think that that's important. And these interventions are surprisingly cost effective.
So this will be my last question, but I do think it's important, which is if we are to do this and we can do it without legislation and even say we get the funding, where does the leadership come from? Ideally, who leads the charge?
Well, at the federal level, it begins with the president. At the state level, it begins with the governor. And, of course, at the local level, it begins with the mayor. The mayor hires the police chief, and the mayor insists that all of his other cabinet members or agency heads collaborate with the police to create a balanced solution. It's not only the mayor, but that's probably the single most important figure. Beyond that, of course, you need law enforcement open and able to collaborate, and you need leadership at the community level. But that chief executive, either at the federal, state, or local level, is essential. And mayors are extremely important because, like politics, as Tip O'Neill was fond of saying, all crime is local.
Okay, I lied. That wasn't the last question. One more, and then I will rein myself in. But with that said, is it not then part of the problem that we don't have that leadership?
Well, that's really why I wrote this book. I've been doing this work for a long time, and frankly, I've had more access than most to policymakers at the local, state, and federal level. I've been in the White House, I've been in the state houses, and I've been in the city halls. And I've had the opportunity to pitch in person these policies. Sometimes I was successful, and sometimes I wasn't. And one of the reasons that I wasn't successful was because there was really no political constituency for the policies that I was advocating for. And so while the evidence might have sounded good, while it might have made sense in terms of the budget, there was really no constituency that said, we need these programs and we need them now. And that's really what I'm trying to do by writing this book for a mainstream audience. I'm really trying to cut out the middle manager and go right to the top, because I think if voters and the public demand these programs, their leaders will fall in line.
The name of the book is Bleeding Out: The Devastating Consequences of Urban Violence and a Bold New Plan for Peace in the Streets. It is published by Basic Books. Thomas Apt, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing with us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Bleeding Out: The Devastating Consequences of Urban Violence and a Bold New Plan for Peace in the Streets. Thomas Apt is the author. Basic Books is the publisher. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.